I try to, for example, with building and very straight lines, as Anna is such in a mess in her life, I try to give her like lines and symmetrical thing and architecture to her life. And as she's trying to do the tiling in the bathroom and so on to put things well, I need in something in the location, in the picture, to give a guide.
Fresh from an attention-grabbing run at this year's Berlin Film Festival, Rachel Lang's Baden Baden hits theatres in the United Kingdom this week. We'll hear more from the filmmaker today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
One Friday night, the entrance hall of Rome's Macro Contemporary Art Museum is filled with unusual noises. About 50 people are sitting on the floor, watching a mesmerizing display of scratchy zigzags and blurry lines.
How do the technicalities of film projection impact the way we consume our movies? We'll touch down in Rome for a recap of this year's Live Cinema Festival. Plus,
I mean, I've always believed that the most single useful thing any gay person can do is just to come out. As soon as you do that, then the world begins to change a bit because people realise, oh gosh, there are lots of gay people, but people that I know.
From Four Weddings and a Funeral to My Best Friend's Wedding, we'll look at how the gay best friend has helped to slowly chip away at Hollywood's diversity dilemma. All that plus a peek inside Joan Crawford's wardrobe. That's today on The Cinema Show, right here on Monocle 24. Have you ever tried to build your own shower stall? Look, I'll be honest, I'm fairly partial to the odd home renovation program on daytime television, but I likely wouldn't have considered extending that process into a feature film. I mean, DIY just isn't all that, dramatic. Hello from Midori House in London, and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. The great fictional newspaper editor Perry White once said that a good reporter doesn't get great stories, a good reporter makes them great. Well, that's true for movies too, and indeed for writer and director Rachel Lang's debut feature, Baden Baden. On the surface, we have a directionless young woman returning home to Strasbourg to build a shower, but throw in a few old loves, some dark humour and some existential questions, and the drama almost writes itself. Baden Baden made waves when it premiered in Berlin this year, and it's now set for a theatrical run in the United Kingdom before shifting online, exclusive to Mubi. I sat down with Rachel Lang at London's Soho House this week to ask whether it's still all that audacious to forego the traditional narrative structure.
At the beginning, I have the bathroom speech and the link with the grandma, and that was the original thing. And it took like a lot of time to make it like organic structure and not scenarist thing, you know? I wanted the film to be like life in a movement, very destructure and with difference of timing and so on. And it was a long way to put that block together in with different feeling.
Do you think that that's important then in keeping a story true to life? Because that's really how life plays out, isn't it? It's a series of random events that all, sometimes when we perceive them, seem to culminate into some sort of meaning. Was that what you were trying to do, reflect how you see life itself?
Yeah, trying to give the movement to of life. Also for the viewer, for the spectator, to be an inactive part with that film. So he built also the life meaning. And all the blocks, there are confrontation between them and there are like a gap between things. And the viewer has to build connection between all the blocks and is making also the organic style of the film. You know, trying to be in life with the character and trying to build the Milky Way again, because there is a Milky Way of character around Anna who are drawing Anna's portrait, and everything just enter in shock together, and at the end it creates something organic, you know.
Do you think it's important when we watch films for us to really get something out of the film? We need to be able to join some of those dots ourselves. The movie can't do all of that work for us.
Anna is a character who is trying to experiment and find a way, find meanings, find the way to be in relation with people and so on. And the ellipses in the movie between the blocks are very important for me, to, for the viewer also, to be active and not to consume something passively, but just to be part of the active construction of Anna, to go on and to try to make sense by yourself with the little things you get.
So tell me about the locations that you chose for the movie. When you're setting the scene in a lot of the urban places, we can see shots of buildings, and you seem to have chosen specific locations, seemingly for some sort of reason to get a message across. What were you trying to communicate with the urban landscapes that you were portraying?
I tried to, for example, with building and very straight lines, as Anna is such in a mess in her life, I tried to give her like lines and symmetrical thing and architecture to her life. And as she's trying to do the tiling in the bathroom and so on to put things well, I need in something in the location, in the picture, to give a guide, you know.
Is there something about the environments that you find yourself in that make you feel a certain way? Do you think that the rooms that we're in, the textures that surround us, do they make us feel a certain way and add to the story that we make up in our own minds?
I think so. For example, the apartment of the Boris parents is a different apartment from the one for Anna's grandmother. And I think, yeah, it builds people. When you spend all the film in the tiny bathroom with little tidying things and bathtub and so on, and you finish the film with another architecture, another scale of drawing, of gesture, I think it gives you, not freedom, but yes, a kind of perspective to see further.
How reflective is the film of the way that you feel about the city that it takes place in? Does it represent something that you perceive in your own mind about that particular place?
Yes, I'm from this part of France, so I know this city. At the border of Germany, Swiss and so on, it's a very region that has changed a lot during the last centuries. It has been Germans and French and Germans and French and so on. I wanted to shoot that location, that region, that part of France, because I come from there and so I know it. It's easier to shoot something you know than something you don't know. And also this about the funding, this city gave us money to shoot, and as I was linked emotionally with the city, it was an evidence.
Tu viendras voir sur ton truc à photo, j'ai un virus.
Ah ouais, bah ouais, il y a des trucs inexplicables hein, qui arrivent avec Internet.
T'as rencontré quelqu'un?
Ton père me dit, remets dans ton jupon. Ne touche pas à ce ballon, ça c'est pour les garçons.
45 minutes late. This means that we, all of us, will be 1 hour late. What's your excuse?
A clip from Baden Baden, capping off my interview with the writer and director, Rachel Lang. You can catch her film in cinemas here in the United Kingdom from today, and it will be streaming exclusively on Mubi from next month. Last week, the 2016 Live Cinema Festival in Rome welcomed performers from throughout Europe to the four-day event. It began 3 years ago as a showcase for artists who mix film, video, photography, and other images with music or sound, with the addition of a spontaneous live element too. The result is a rich variety of audiovisual pieces that don't necessarily fit any conventional cinematic genre, as Monocle contributor Frederick Burness discovered.
One Friday night, the entrance hall of Rome's Macro Contemporary Art Museum is filled with unusual noises. About 50 people are sitting on the floor, watching a mesmerizing display of scratchy zigzags and blurry lines, created by an artist manipulating 16mm film reels and a vintage projector. It's the opening night of the city's third live cinema festival, which kicked off with a throwback to the analog age. But organizer Gianluca Del Gobbo says that exploring how older technology can be used in new ways emerged as a key theme for the festival's curators.
The idea was to investigate and go deeper on the digital way of thinking instead of digital tool. So you can use also 60mm and do some generative stuff. And that is something that was never happened when the 16mm was in the best technology. The digital approach doesn't mean that you are using just a digital tool.
Gianluca started running audiovisual events in 2004. He worked as a software engineer and experimented with video art in his spare time, staging projections at clubs and small parties. Before long, he designed a program that links together both of his creative interests.
So at the beginning it was a little bit strange that we was trying to do something real live using VHS, DVD, mixer, and during the day we was developing a huge animation for a customer with the interaction that is something that is really live, no? Because you can build a video with a button. So now when the music starts, something happened. So I started to, okay, let's build an interface that can manage footage of this kind.
He released the software for free, and a community of users started growing. They organized gatherings to share knowledge and showcase their work. And that movement developed into the festival, which is part of an active pan-European network of audiovisual artists. Gianluca has even staged events as far afield as Mexico and South Africa. More than a dozen artists from around Europe were invited to this year's live cinema festival. A duo from Budapest performed Phase Alternating Line, a sound-reactive visual piece which they described as a psychedelic trip into an abstract digital world. In the projection, 3D shapes or strangely detached objects like baby heads warp themselves into twisted visions over a backdrop of dynamic shifting textures, accompanied by a minimal yet punchy soundtrack.
It's very, very, very nice to let the horses loose a little bit.
That's Gabor Kitzinger, who produced the visuals.
I think most of the guys, you know, who are taking part of this, maybe they have other jobs, you know, or other performances where they are very familiar with the situation and they know what they're going to present. But here, you know, you can try out stuff which are very borderline in your situation also.
Gabor says the piece is about 60% improvised, with a loose structure of scenes planned in advance.
The process is kind of like, you can say the same, but still every time is different because every venue, every crowd, every performance, every setup, every rig you are working on, basically, you know, what the place provides is different. So it's always like one of a kind experience. And that's what's interesting about presenting this kind of audiovisual stuff live, because it's live. It's like once and never again, it's going to be the same.
The final performance of this year's festival was Dimension N, a collaboration between artists from Poland and Spain. The format is open. While musician Darius Makaruk creates melancholy melodies, visual artist Alba Corral is sketching on a digital easel in real time, projecting her swirling surreal images for all to see. The live cinema festival has grown every year since it began, but organizers say their main challenge is communicating exactly what live cinema really means. From slightly weird virtual trips to improvisations with analog film reels and immersive visuals that feel like computer games, the lineup was extremely diverse. Gianluca Del Gobbo believes that understanding of this hybrid art form will develop over time, as it expands into more established venues like the Macro Museum. For now, the art of live cinema may remain a niche interest, even for culture vultures and film buffs. But it's come a long way from those early days of experimenting with VHS tapes in underground clubs around Rome. And the European scene will surely continue to flourish. For Monocle, in Rome, I'm Frederick Burness.
Thanks, Frederick. Still to come on The Cinema Show, the actor and writer Simon Callow discusses the realities facing gay actors today. And we'll take a sneaky look inside Joan Crawford's wardrobe. Shh, hopefully no one finds out. Stay tuned.
Do you like good films? Well, you're in luck. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening at the moment. Just for our loyal listeners, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. because life is too short for bad films.
The Report Card, brought to you by The Cinema Show. $1 million, that's how much director Joss Whedon has pledged to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. He's released a 3-minute video featuring Robert Downey Jr., Scarlett Johansson, and Mark Ruffalo, among others, aimed at encouraging young people to vote.
On Tuesday, November 8th, this country will make one of the most important... The most important decisions in its history. You have a chance.
You have an obligation.
To be a part of that decision.
$2.1 billion, that's how much Star Wars The Force Awakens raked in at the box office, making it the third highest grossing film of all time. Disney chief Bob Iger says he didn't expect the next installment to attract quite that level of interest, but the feverish response to the trailer and posters has the company feeling positive. Disney has already announced 2 more sequels to the series focused on the Skywalkers, as well as a spin-off centered on a plot to steal plans for the Death Star and an origin story for Han Solo.
Look, Your Worshipfulness, let's get one thing straight. I take orders from just one person, me.
So when are you still alive?
321 minutes. That's the running time of Andy Warhol's 1963 film Sleep, which is quite literally a very long look at his friend sleeping for 5 hours and 20 minutes. Jared Leto is set to star in a new film about the legendary artist, which will be written by the creator of Boardwalk Empire, Terrence Winter. We assume the 5-hour nap won't make the final cut.
You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. The 1994 film, Four Weddings and a Funeral, was one of those rare successes that almost seemed to create a whole new genre. Like Bridget Jones's Baby, which of course has just hit cinemas, the film reminded audiences of how British cinema can approach the tricky business of modern love in a distinctly English fashion. But there was another aspect to the film that also helped push boundaries. Simon Callow starred as Gareth, one member of a circle of friends who just happened to be gay. Years later, Rupert Everett also pushed a few boundaries of his own, with his role alongside Julia Roberts in My Best Friend's Wedding. Mainstream movies have changed quite a bit in the decades since those rom-coms were on the big screen. But what about the difficulties facing gay actors? I asked Simon Callow.
Hollywood is an industry which creates a product which it wishes to sell to the widest number of people possible. And still, just in America, the majority of people, especially in middle America, are conservative and white and would probably describe themselves as Christians and don't enjoy seeing other people who are not like them represented on the screen. So it's a completely commercial consideration. When occasionally a film like Brokeback Mountain sort of passes into the mainstream, it's a sort of miracle, but Hollywood thinks, well, we won't manage to get away with that twice, you know. And it was only Brokeback Mountain was only allowed that status by being made exclusively by heterosexuals. As far as I'm aware, there isn't a single homosexual involved in the making of Brokeback Mountain, neither the original book writer, nor the actors, nor the director, nor the cinematographer, nor anybody. There were probably a few people in the wardrobe department if you really went into it. But I don't think that... So it's interesting that that's a perfectly heterosexual view of bisexuality, actually, rather than homosexuality, but whatever. The only interesting question to me is that I believe it was true in England and I believe it would be true in America, but is anybody going to test it? Is that I honestly think that people are a lot more savvy than we give them credit for, you know, the silent majority and all of that. And people like in England, the whole process in Britain, I should say, the whole process of the dismantlement of these incredibly repressive laws, which came about mostly at the end of the 19th century, has been pretty, it was hard won, and there were some casualties along the way. But It turned out, anyway, by the time that most of these laws were passed, the 1967 Sexual Offences Act, which decriminalised homosexuality for people under 21, and then the slow reduction of the age of consent and all that, passed, by the moment that they were passed, they had already happened in people's minds. I mean, I've always believed that the most single useful thing any gay person can do is just to come out. As soon as you do that, then the world begins to change a bit because people realise, oh, gosh, there are lots of gay people, but people that I know, people, you know, my brother, my greengrocer, my lawyer, these are all gay people. So gay people aren't these weird, weird, kinky people.
But what exactly does it mean for you to come out? Is that someone who has to actually say, I am gay?
Yeah.
Or can you simply exist as a gay person and have people work it out?
In the end, no. I'm sorry, I don't think so. I think in the end you have to say it. It's not that I'm not a very politically active person, but I did absolutely feel that I couldn't go on, I couldn't lie about it, because I was, at the time that I went to the National Theatre to play Mozart in Amadeus, because Paul Scofield refused to give interviews, and Felicity Kendall, who was playing my wife, had given probably too many interviews, the new kid on the block was fielded to the journalists. And, of course, they all wanted to know about my private life. And I just said, you know, I'm gay. But they wouldn't print it. They would not print it.
Unbelievable.
Well, because they wanted to find me out. They didn't want me to tell them. That's not the way journalism works.
Being gay undoubtedly affected someone like Rupert Everett. Do you think it affected your acting career? Do you have any, I wouldn't say you have any regrets about it at all, but do you have any sort of thought in retrospect that, oh, maybe if I hadn't done that, I might have been here?
It's impossible for me to know what parts I didn't get. Nobody has ever told me I didn't give you the part because you were gay. So they weren't going to, were they? In Rupert's case, I mean, Rupert is a compulsive stirrer up of things, and I think he just found it impossible not simply to say that he was gay, but to be provocative and outrageous. So he became identified in the public mind as a very, very gay, as a sort of gay firebrand, you know. I didn't particularly do that. But then my case was different. Rupert was an incredibly beautiful young man who was, certainly in his first film, well, not actually his very first film role, he was gay, but other film roles, was playing straight romantic roles. That has never been my lot, so it wasn't quite such an issue. But I deeply regret that Rupert is discouraging actors now from coming out, as indeed has Miriam Margolyes, to my shock, who's also been very, you know, open, and now is saying, I regret it because it killed my mother. I'm very sorry, of course, that that is the case, but I don't think that that's a sufficient reason. I think that's all we can do. We can only testify in the end to who we are.
The actor and writer Simon Callow. And now finally today, if you were to hunt through Joan Crawford's wardrobe, what do you think you might find?
No war hangers!
Well, certainly not. The truth is, of course, Joan Crawford is one of those rare icons who seems to define just about every decade in which she worked, from the silent era right up until the late 1960s. In the mid-1950s, however, she made a film with director Nicholas Ray in blazing true colour, an in-house colour process used by Republic Pictures. The result was Johnny Guitar, a bright, over-the-top, almost camp extravaganza. Let's hear now from the former fashion editor Brian Lewandowski as he sorts through the piles of yellow blouses and red neckties in Joan's wardrobe.
Johnny Guitar. Few films strike such stark dichotomies. First, there's the obvious, the one kept aloft by film critics even today. Serious Western or camp classic? But to a certain sartorially discerning eye, another glaring contrast rears its colorful head, that being the film itself versus star Joan Crawford's wardrobe, a campy, colorful parade of costumes that constantly prompts the viewer to question, what is she wearing?
All you can buy up these stairs is a bullet in the head. Now, which do you want?
Let's approach this in the grand tradition of it's not what you wear, but how you wear it. It's a Western, so aside from the frills and corsets of the occasional saloon dress typically seen in such films, one doesn't expect too much extravagance. As a matter of fact, on that front, the film nails the realism with a drab, almost morose wardrobe for the rest of the cast, perhaps best exemplified by what could be mistaken for a nun's garb worn by co-star Mercedes McCambridge for the duration of the film. But it's precisely this drabness that brings to life getup after getup worn by Crawford. It's a tableau of color against the otherwise monochromatic, a move that calls to mind a scene from another Joan Crawford flick, The Women, in which the black and white gives way to a few moments of technicolor during a fashion show.
Thanks for the tip. But when anything I wear doesn't please Stephen, I take it off.
In Johnny Guitar, Crawford plays Vienna, a saloon keeper whose out-of-place, almost anachronistic wardrobe suggests she's certainly not a local, and not just in the tiny Arizona cattle town in which the film takes place, but in the entire Wild West itself. To quote Variety at the time, it proves Crawford should leave the saddles and Levi's to someone else and stick to the city lights for a background. Her first scene is atop a balcony of stairs, where she stands dressed in a buttoned-up shirt and western tie, perfectly made up in that refined, big-city way, a look implying, I may live here, but I get all my clothes at the Saks Fifth Avenue, as though Saks Fifth Avenue had been a thing at the time. The actual wardrobe is anything but glamorous. Rather, the glamour of each outfit is the result of its presence. There's a collection of broadcloth shirts in primary colors, worn with highly contrasting western neckties and jodhpurs. There's this bright yellow shirt with a red kerchief look that calls to mind a vintage McDonald's uniform. There's a typical Wild West dress, white, full length with billowy sleeves, and by far the most decorated look takes the form of a pink dress with frilly trim, worn under a red velvet cape. Taken out of the context of this film, each look could say something entirely different from, class, I'm your new teacher, Miss Crawford, to, I'm here for the rodeo party, where's the punch? But that's the exact moment in which presence commands glamour. It's also where the harsh criticism comes in. It's far too easy to call Johnny Guitar a camp classic and be done with it. And though I myself am certainly not above assembling a group of friends and making a night out of lambasting the hell out of it over a few bottles of champagne, I can't deny credit where it's due. Sure, watching her play piano in what appears to be a pleated bedsheet against a backdrop of a cave garners its moment of camp admiration, but like I said, it's too easy. It's Joan Crawford, after all. There's got to be more. And there is. The legacy of Johnny Guitar has remained relevant and is evident even today, referenced in a variety of films, most notably Pedro Almodovar's Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, and here we are talking about it today. Which begs the question, what else would you want Joan Crawford to wear in a Western? That's just the kind of film it is. Let's let the camp parade known as Joan Crawford's wardrobe do its job, and define Johnny Guitar not simply as a Western with an audaciously dressed lead character, but rather a true color Western, with a wardrobe narrative all its own. In the business, we're so quick to point out items of clothing that can allegedly speak for themselves, but we so rarely give them a chance to do so. If there's a lesson to be learned here, it's that camp and quality aren't mutually exclusive.
The former fashion editor Brian Lewandowski there, rummaging through Joan Crawford's wardrobe. That blazing 1954 classic, Johnny Guitar, is playing right now on Mubi here in the United Kingdom. Do check it out if you can. And that's it for today. We're at the Raindance Film Festival next week, and 61 years after the death of James Dean, we'll turn our attention to the 2012 Curiosity, Joshua Tree, 1951.
Say, you live around here?
A few blocks. By the pier.
Got anything to drink?
Do you like tequila?
Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolin Goffin. Listen again and find out more over at our website, monocle.com, and do not forget to subscribe to the podcast as well. You can do that at iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thanks for listening.
Where are you from?
Some place you never heard of. Fairmount, Indiana.
What about you?
Close by Malibu.